Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The past few years have brought rapid growth in small-scale solar power in Michigan, and that growth has been helped by net metering. You put panels on your roof or in your yard, you save money because you're buying less electricity. And if you generate more electricity than you use, you sell it back to the utility. That's net metering. And that practice is generating a debate. How much should those solar customers be compensated for the energy they generate? A bill sponsored by Michigan Senator John Prose would cut the compensation. Under SB 438, utilities would buy excess rooftop solar power at wholesale rates and then require net metering customers to buy power off the grid at retail rates. The bill is being taken up today by the Senate Committee on Energy and Technology. State Senator John Prose is here with us now. Senator, why is this bill necessary?
Well, it's necessary when we look at the actions of the federal government most recently, and we have to take into account some of the concerns that we as a state have as it relates to reliability, meaning when we flip the switch, do our lights turn on? And it also relates very directly to affordability, because all of us demand that we have reliable power, that it be there, but that it be affordable in the process, too. So Senator Mike Nofs, the chairman of the Energy and Technology Committee, I serve as vice chairman of that committee, have coordinated our efforts together in a bipartisan way to bring Republicans and Democrats together to answer the question of how we're going to manage our own energy resources going forward. Senator Nofs' bill deals much more with the production and the utility side of the equation. That's Senate Bill 437. And then, of course, in Senate Bill 438, the one that you're referencing and the reason that we're talking today, that bill is tie-barred together with 437, which basically means that the both of them work hand in glove to update Michigan's energy policy, keeping in mind that reliability, affordability, and the use of new technologies that are oftentimes green technologies are at the forefront of what we're doing in the future. And we're trying to find that right landing spot, that right mix, to ensure that we are addressing all of those things in these two bills as we try to manage our own destiny, since the federal government is certainly giving us plenty of mandated requirements to take coal offline. And so how can we put that right balance together to increase Michigan control over its own destiny?
Well, looking at more closely at this issue with net metering, and
yes,
and critics, many of them in the solar industry in Michigan, are saying, in essence, this would be like you grow your own vegetables, you sell them to the grocery store at wholesale prices, but you'd have to buy the vegetables back at retail prices. Is that a fair analogy?
I don't think it's a fair analogy at all. I think what we're trying to do is recognize that there's a certain cost of participation on the grid. While you may benefit the grid at a certain point in time because of the investment, oftentimes tens of thousands of dollars that an individual has invested in, say, rooftop solar, that while you may want to sell that back to the grocery store, you still have to use the roadway to transport your product to sell at the grocery store. And that roadway is otherwise known for us in Michigan as the grid. Are we ensuring that the grid is maintained so that all other users can participate in the reliability that we demand? And so we look at this and say, how can we equitably and fairly land in a public policy position that ensures that the grid is taken care of while you still can produce your own rooftop solar energy for yourself?
You know, as we speak, this is the week that the Brookings Institution just released a report looking at solar and at net metering and the factors you cite and how net metering is impacting states all across the country. And it notes regulators in at least 10 states commission independent studies to kind of really figure out the actual cost and benefits to net metering. Has the Michigan Public Service Commission conducted its own independent study, to your knowledge?
To date, the Michigan Public Service Commission has not been instructed to do so. That's certainly one of the discussions that, in fact, we will have very shortly, yet today even, as we speak about the S2 substitutes that are before us, which basically means that we've rewritten the bill once already since its introduction a year ago. We've had literally hundreds, quite literally thousands of hours of testimony and discussion, both behind closed doors and in public forums. Anybody and everybody who's had something to say about this particular bill and Senate Bill 437, mm-hmm. They've all had a hearing. They've all had the ability to speak about it. And you're right. Many have said, let's let the commission do a rate case, if you will, identify just exactly what the value is. I think where we are, is looking at the grid and its reliability, making sure that it stays as robust and as secure as possible, because all of us demand that we have that power available. So the question that we ask then is, what is reasonable to ensure that everybody pays their fair share? And you might recall the 2008 Energy Act that passed in the state of Michigan really sought to achieve cost of service. And what that means is, if it costs a certain value for you to utilize energy, then you should pay only what it costs for you to utilize it, meaning what are the operations and maintenance and distribution costs, right? Mm. So you shouldn't have to pay for somebody else's rates, just like businesses and industries shouldn't pay for yours. They should pay what their fair share is for what it costs to actually utilize that energy. So we want to make sure that everybody's actually paying their fair share in the process, and recognize that those new technologies, like rooftop solar, have a place in today's technology mix. You should be able to utilize that, and we agree that that should remain the case. We're trying to find the right public policy that also ensures that we don't have individual folks who are becoming energy producers to the point that we lose reliability and the effectiveness of the grid. So that's really where this balance is, and where a lot of the friction exists when we try to find the public policy solution that's best for all concerned.
I know you said there were, you know, thousands of pages of testimony, but before that, when you were pulling this bill together initially, where did you get the information that you used to base this proposed bill on? What sources?
So the original bill of introduction was looking at other states and other states who have unrolled their original net metering language. You know, in the 2008 Act, the net metering language was designed to give a kickstart to green technologies like solar and wind, and those who wanted to do independent power producing, quite frankly, because as a rooftop solar operator, you become an independent producer of your own electricity that you utilize for your own benefit, and then you want to sell that back to the grid. But what's happening is that as those technologies become more cost competitive, it also becomes a more of a regulatory concern as we try to make sure that we have the things that we've talked about today, Cynthia, with affordability and reliability, and a maintenance of the grid that is our freeway system that transports our products back and forth. So that was the bill of introduction. We looked at other states and said, hey, how are we going to manage this issue? We made changes, significant changes, I might add, with the S2 that was introduced a couple of weeks ago. There's been significant, about a month ago, there's been significant debate and discussion on the S2 substitute, and I'd expect, without breaking any news today, that you'll see even more significant changes in the S3 substitute in just the next hour.
Senator, I just want to shift gears a little bit over to something that really underlies all of these efforts to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels and look for viable alternative energy resources, and that is the larger issue of climate change. And as we've seen, the Republican Party has largely adopted the position that questions whether climate change is caused by human actions. And I'm just wondering, what is your take on that? How do you view the role of human actions on global warming and climate change?
Well, I don't think there's a doubt that human actions have an impact on the climate, just as human actions have had an impact forever, for as long as we've been participants on this earth of ours. And we all have a responsibility to ensure that the climate is as clean as possible, recognizing, too, that we have put ourselves in a position that these new technologies should have a chance to succeed. And we really go to great pains in working with the Public Service Commission in 437 and 438 to ensure, Cynthia, that in fact, the least expensive fuel gets the benefit.
State Senator John Pierce, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you very much, Cynthia.
Last year, the California-based company SolarCity was ranked the top solar residential contractor in the nation. That was according to Solar Power World. Will Craven is its director of communications. Will, we just spoke with Republican Senator John Prose. Can you tell us about your thoughts on his bill and how it would affect the solar industry in Michigan?
It would keep thousands of jobs out of Michigan. What Americans have found, as different states have gotten access to rooftop solar, and I would say Michigan is not yet one of those, but what 20 states and more that SolarCity serve, what they have found is that when you finally get the choice to have an alternative to utility power, people love that choice. You do not see a thriving rooftop solar industry anywhere where there is not net metering. It is one of the bedrock policies, and Michigan really has a choice to make if it wants to create the sort of thriving job-creating rooftop solar industry that other states are enjoying now. It should keep net metering in place.
Now, supporters of Senator Pruce's bill say it'll improve access to renewable energy. And also, they make an argument that solar users aren't paying their fair share to maintain the grid, and everyday ratepayers are subsidizing them. How do you answer those arguments?
When someone goes solar, they're simply reducing the amount of utility power they're consuming. You cannot say that someone just deciding to use less utility power means that they suddenly owe the utility money for what they're not purchasing any longer. Going solar is no different than using a certain light less or unplugging an appliance. You are simply reducing your consumption of utility power, and anyone should be able to do that, including solar customers, who are actually doing a good thing for their community and for the planet, and as well as for the finances of their family.
Now, we're seeing rule changes and legislation pushes all over the country involving solar power, and one of the big battles taking place is in the very sunny state of Nevada. And you think this could be a sign of things to come if Michigan's bill is passed. What's happened in Nevada?
Nevada was an amazing story, in which for the first time people finally got the choice to go solar. They went solar in droves. Nevada quickly became the state with the most solar jobs per capita in the nation. And then the Public Utilities Commission made a grave mistake. They reduced the net metering value, they decimated the industry, and they ended the people's ability to go solar. So it was an incredibly positive story before it became a tragic one. And we think there's a future for solar in Nevada again, but I think the lesson there for Michigan is that you really want to keep the right policies in place so that you can give people consumer choice. You can give them the option to go solar, and you can create thousands of jobs while doing it.
Will Craven is Director of Communications for Solar City. Will, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Up next, the mystery behind the Kalamazoo Gals, the women who built Gibson guitars during World War II. That mystery lives on. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In the summer of 2013, we had a great conversation here on Stateside about the Kalamazoo Gals. We met law professor and music journalist John Thomas. He wrote a book called Kalamazoo Gals, a story of extraordinary women and Gibson's banner guitars of World War II. He'd uncovered the story of women who built some 9,000 guitars at the Gibson headquarters in Kalamazoo during World War II, even though the company's official position was no instruments were built through the war. But Banner Gibsons indeed were built. And we met one of the Kalamazoo gals, Irene Stearns. Now, in the 3 years since we had that talk, there have been some very peculiar twists. So let's talk about them now as we welcome John Thomas and Irene Stearns. So good to have you both back with us.
It's wonderful to be back, and it's wonderful to be at least virtually in Irene's presence. Hello, Irene.
Hey, hi, John. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. John, I want you to set the stage for us and remind us again about the photograph you found that set you on this voyage.
Well, I found a photograph that really brought together all the things in life I like. There was mystery, there was music, and a possibility of social justice. So as you pointed out in the introduction, Gibson's official position has always been, to this day actually, that it built no musical instruments, including guitars, during the war. The men who were at the factory had gone off to fight against evil incarnate, and they couldn't make musical instruments. But I found a photograph of some 75 women standing in front of the Gibson factory. It looked like 1940s to me. It turned out to be 1944. I ended up eventually finding an original print of the photograph. And I couldn't figure out why these women were there, and so I started thinking about it. I went back and looked at the company history. The person who had been the personnel director during the war, a man named Julius Belson, later wrote a history of Gibson, published in the 70s, in which he wrote, and I confirmed this as I was doing my research, Gibson built no musical instruments during the war. And so that started me on my journey. Eventually, I did discover that Gibson built musical instruments. One of the first stops was to talk my way into Gibson corporate headquarters. A very nice mid-level executive set me up there in an office, a company guitar for the 4 days I was there, and gave me access to the World War II shipping ledgers. I photographed 4,400 pages, ended up counting those up. There were about 9,000 of these what we call banner guitars, Banner Gibsons, because of a little decal on the headstock up where the strings attach. But Gibson made a lot of other kinds of guitars and mandolins and banjos and all that sort of thing. So about 25,000 total instruments. So now I had a mystery on my hands. And it led me to write this book.
And indeed, one of the hands that helped build those instruments belonged to Irene Stearns. Irene, remind us again What was your job? I think I remember they made very good use of your small hands.
Oh, well, I made strings most of the time, but part of the time I coiled. I liked that the best. Took the strings and wound them up, stuck them in a bag, and put them in a little box, and you had to make a set of them. That was it. So
now about I found 12 women in this photograph, and about a third of them built strings. About a third of them did administrative kinds of work, and about a third of them built guitars. And I think that probably was a fair sample of what women did during the war. And as I've always tell Irene, without the strings, the guitars could have made no music. So that was a very important part of the process.
And these are wonderful guitars. Give us a little sample. You have a Banner Gibson with you now, John. Give us a sense of what they sound like.
I do. This is one that shipped June 23, 1943. I'll play a little snippet of an old song.
That is amazing to think this is, you know, we're talking about a 73-year-old guitar with this beautiful, beautiful sound. Well, when we talked 3 years ago as your book came out, you were getting the idea, were you not, John, that Gibson was getting ready to acknowledge the existence of the Kalamazoo Gals.
And that's right. Initially, of course, Gibson, I think, didn't know the story. Modern Gibson did not. And as the book was about to come out, Gibson contacted me through a dealer in the Boston area. I live out east here. And proposed a project, which was to replicate my personal guitars, to make 50 copies each of my personal guitars. They wanted 4 guitars. I actually borrowed guitars from friends. 2 were mine, 2 were friends, sent them off. Everything started out happily. They were going to replicate these guitars. I had 3 requests. My first was not a request. I did not want any money out of this. This was just before the book had been published, but it started, and it was in process when we last spoke. I asked that the women who work at the Gibson Acoustic Division, which is in Montana, build the guitars. There were enough women to do this, that I be able to inspect the prototypes to make sure that they're up to the standards of someone like Irene Stearns, and that some portion, and I didn't specify a percentage, but some portion of the proceeds of each sale go to a Women History Project. Gibson said, great. We went off. Things looked swimming. Initially, Gibson was so thrilled. Gibson actually underwrote my book release party, which happened in Seattle. I live out east, but in Seattle is a publication for which I write often called Fretboard Journal. And in conjunction with Fretboard Journal, Gibson sponsored the book release party, flew me out there, flew guitars out, flew an executive out. We had a wonderful party, a book release. The Gibson executive spoke glowingly in front of the crowd and on camera about the project and the gals and what a unique and important part of history I'd uncovered.
So this is all sounding great.
It was great. And then it went silent. Gibson stopped returning my phone calls or emails. I wanted to know what was the status of the project, but I began to get worried about the guitars. These are, as you say, 70-plus-year-old instruments. 2 were not mine. They can become very valuable over time. There weren't that many made initially, and they've suffered the ravages of time. And so at one point, someone said, I think we think the guitars are around here somewhere.
Whoa.
I finally got through. So it really scared me again, especially from the ones that weren't mine. So it took about 10 months to get them back. I kept sending emails, which were not returned. I finally got a response to my inquiry. This is from the executive at the Acoustic Division who attended my book release party and spoke about the project. And I asked her for a status update. I've been asking her and the general manager and other people and hadn't gotten a response, but I finally got a response. In anticipation of this interview, I actually printed out that email, and here's the full response. This is the only word I ever got.
Okay.
The status of the replicas is this. We did a 1942 J45, an LG2 Mahogany, and a Southern Jumbo. All are sold out, period.
That's that.
No thank you. No thank you. No reference to the gals. Now, I can say this, that the general manager at the Acoustic Division was so excited about this project, he had scheduled me to appear with him at a giant trade show that happens every January in Los Angeles. It's called NAMM, National Association of Music Merchants. And we were going to have a press conference announcing the release of the guitars and their relationship to the Kalamazoo Gals. He scheduled it for 11 o'clock on a Saturday. This is a trade show where over 100,000 people attend. He wanted to pick peak hour and bought me tickets and a plane ticket and a ticket to attend the trade show, and then went silent. That didn't happen. He didn't invite me out. He stopped returning my calls. He left the company. Everybody left the company.
Why do you think this? Why did they ghost you like this, do you think?
I really have no idea. I mean, I have guesses.
All right. What's your guesses?
Well, I think that the company operates uniquely, to put it nicely, and that perhaps the acoustic division doesn't talk or hadn't gotten an okay for the project with the president, who is the headquarters in Nashville. And once they started thinking about the project, got worried. Why they'd worry, I don't know. I do know that maybe, you know, this is another case of history repeating itself, that Gibson had refused to recognize in the 1940s, but up to this day, the contributions of Irene and her female colleagues. And maybe this is another continuation. My proposition, I think I support it very well in the book, is that Gibson just didn't think the buying public would embrace female-made guitars in World War II. And it's the 40s. I could kind of understand that.
Yeah.
It looks like history repeated itself and Gibson started thinking the same thing. I don't have a better explanation.
And I know they've actually come to the point where they say, we've never heard of John Thomas or his guitar. And then they actually were making noises about suing you.
Right. So I had two more encounters. One was a phone call. I had a chat with this woman who had hosted the book release party.
All right.
And I had tracked down the person who had been appointed to spearhead the project on the floor. This was a woman who just recently left Gibson, I think for unrelated reasons, but she was the head of the custom shop, which did all the fancy inlays. So when Johnny Depp gets a guitar with a pirate ship inlaid on it in honor of Pirates of the Caribbean, she did that work. She was appointed to head the project. She was the woman to supervise the other women. And she contacted me. I'm trying to contact her. The executives won't talk to me. I think maybe, you know, the real people will talk to me.
Yeah.
And she said, this executive called me in. She's my boss. She told me if I talk to you about this project, they will fire me. Kind of weird.
Wow.
So I contacted the executive. I happened to be in the Northwest at the time in Montana. I said, can we meet? And she said, well, we have to meet outside the plant. We met. And I said, this person told me that you told her you would fire her if she talked to you about the project. And this executive said to me, yeah, that's right. We'll fire anybody who talks to you about the project. Like, you know, what? Why? I'm just this little guy who wrote this little book. So that was the initial inquiry and curious. The second encounter happened about a year or so later. This would be about a year and a half ago. The BBC did an hour-long radio documentary based on the book narrated by Susie Quattro, a woman most people of my generation know as Leather Tuscadero from the Happy Days.
A Detroiter.
Program. Yes, that's right. A Michiganiter.
Mm-hmm.
And she narrated. She was the narrator of the program. And BBC came to Kalamazoo, and we interviewed Irene, and we did some interviews in a factory. Then the BBC had me go to London, where I got to sit with Leather Tuscadero herself in her leather pants and do an interview. And to sort of make the circle connect at the end, the BBC contacted Gibson. The head of global public relations told Gibson, we've never heard of John Thomas or his book, but he violated our copyright by accessing our shipping ledgers, to which the BBC guy said, I thought you said you never heard of him. You know, sort of a little curious. But he said, why don't you talk to her? So I spoke with her, and she told me the same things. And I said, this is kind of curious that you say you've never heard of me. You guys sponsored my book release party, paid my plane ticket, paid for the refreshments and the venue, and one of your executives came out and talked glowingly about me and the book and also the project to replicate the guitars. And she said, well, can you prove that?
Wow.
I said, well, you know, I don't have to prove it, but if you want to know, it's on YouTube. You can find it yourself. And it still is out there. So and then she threatened me with seeking remedies against him. I think that was her phrase. If I didn't reveal who let me into the building just to access the shipping records.
I refuse to give up the name. Going down this such an odd wormhole with all of this, and I'm sure as this has all evolved, it's clear you have no clue why they're acting the way they're acting. Are you giving up, John, on Gibson, or do you still want to try to get them to acknowledge the Kalamazoo Gals?
Well, I've given up on them as far as cooperating with me. Although they don't owe me anything. But I think they owe the gals a footnote in history. I think they should do the right thing and recognize the contribution of these wonderful women who worked without complaint in the darkest hours of our country's history, built what everybody says are the best guitars in Gibson's history. And I think it would be the right thing to do in terms of social justice, in terms of humanity, in terms of recognizing the contributions of women in history, to step forward and say, hey, this is really a great story, and we would like to applaud these women who built these guitars.
And Irene Stearns, as one of the women who helped build these guitars, does it matter to you whether Gibson acknowledges you and the other Kalamazoo gals?
Well, I don't think so. I never realized all of this, you know, when I was working there. Although now I know, you know, I got fired. Now I know how that was. I didn't understand it for years, but knowing what's going on now, still going on, you know.
Irene is always so modest, but she got fired because she stood up for the rights of another female worker, a pregnant woman who was tired and needed to go home after completing her quota. And Irene organized the comrades to stand arm to arm with her, and they all got fired. So I think Irene is in her quiet and articulate way, noting that Gibson has had some problems with women over the years.
Well, let me ask you this, Irene. So you've got, you know, you're thanks to John Thomas and his book, you have been in the spotlight as a Kalamazoo gal. There have been interviews, you know, documentary on the BBC, articles, a museum exhibit. What has this meant to you to know that others have certainly accepted this history and they really, really, really like it?
Well, I still can't understand it. I'm awful glad it happened, though, because now I have John and his family and all the fun we've had, but I still can't understand how this all happened.
The book is Kalamazoo Gals, A Story of Extraordinary Women in Gibson's Banner Guitars of World War II, written by my guest John Thomas, and Irene Stearns, one of those very special Kalamazoo gals. Well, it's been some weird twists and turns to the story since we last spoke, but again, it's certainly clear that based on the popularity of the book and the interest in the story, a lot of people outside of Gibson are very, very happy to applaud what you did, Irene.
Well, thank you.
John, it was always great talking with you. Keep us posted.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having us back, and especially for allowing me to chat with one of my favorite people on the planet, Irene Stearns, the Kalamazoo gal.
Yeah.
Stateside reached out to Gibson for comment on this story, but we got no response to email and phone calls. By day, Robert Wax teaches fifth grade. David West is a software engineer. By night, they rock out playing shows at music festivals and nightclubs. Metro Detroit's Crashing Cairo is just out with their new single called Cotton Pillow. And this Friday, they'll open for Eddie Money at DTE Energy in Clarkston. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia has more.
Rock band Crashing Cairo has opened for the Verve Pipe six times. Lead singer Robert Wax opened for Kid Rock twice. Now the band is getting ready to play on the biggest stage of its life, this Friday night at DTE Energy Music Theater, a.k.a. Pine Knob. They open for 80s rock star Eddie Money, a dream come true for drummer David West.
I grew up literally across the street from Pine Knob, and I could hear it every concert in the summertime. And what's kind of crazy is that Eddie Money is the second concert I was ever at. I was 12 years old, and I saw him on that very stage that I'm playing with him, you know, a few years later.
Lead singer Robert Wax jokes around when he describes the music.
If you were to take Radiohead, U2, The National, and Coldplay and put them in a blender, and then afterwards scoop off the scum off the top, we sound like the scum.
Okay, that might not sound like your cup of tea, but come on, the guys are having a good time. Here's a taste of the new single, Cotton Pillow. Since breaking into the indie rock scene in 2007, Crashing Cairo has been playing venues throughout the East and Midwest. Drummer David West remembers a few times when the band played for just a handful of people at empty bars, not a glamorous setting for an aspiring rock star.
Because you have a bad night or a couple bad nights or a show where there's, you know, seven people, you can't let that bring you down and use that as a rehearsal together.
Right.
And just hone your skills.
Yeah.
And then just hope that the next venue's a little bit more crowded.
Yep.
The guys in the band all have day jobs, families, other commitments, but they all make time for music. Wax tells his fifth graders it's okay to be more than one thing.
For some reason, we're programmed into thinking just we have to be one thing.
Right.
And I love that each member of the band just has developed this thought that you don't have to be one thing.
Crashing Cairo will open for Eddie Money on Friday night at DTE Energy.
I've been telling some of my friends, hey, look, if I die right after I'm done with my last song, I'm okay with it. I'm good. You know, I did everything in my life I wanted to.
For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Beatles have come to the Henry Ford Museum. The Dearborn Landmark has just opened its doors to the Magical History Tour, a 10,000-square-foot exhibit telling the complete story of the Beatles from their boyhood days in Liverpool to their solo careers and lives after the band broke up in 1970. The exhibit was assembled by Exhibits Development Group of Minnesota. Will Peterson of EDG is with us now. Henry Ford Museum is the first U.S. museum to host Magical History Tour. How come Michigan got first crack?
You know, we get that question a lot, and what we like to say is we didn't choose Michigan. Michigan chose us. So we have a number of exhibitions on tour at the moment, and we market them to museums or other venues that we think would be interested in hosting them. And it really comes down to tour schedules for the exhibitions and availability of space for the different museums and different venues. You know, it's sort of a matchmaking process, and we're just thrilled that we were able to make a match with the Henry Ford.
Now, the exhibition is constructed in four sections. Can you tell us a little about those divisions as you kind of take us through the career arc of the Beatles?
Absolutely. We would call them galleries in the exhibition world. The first gallery starts with the beginnings and the influences and really looks at the four members of the Beatles before they were the Beatles. So you get to look at John, Paul, George, and Ringo when they were young men growing up in England and, you know, who they're listening to. You know, they're listening to Elvis and Buddy Holly, and they were getting inspired by both American and European music, and really just shows kind of what they were interested in. You know, they were artists, they were musicians, and you learn a little bit about them. You know, you learn about their families, how their mothers helped them, encouraged them to become artists and musicians, and, you know, just the beginnings of these four gentlemen before they became the Beatles. From there, you travel on the road with the band. We've got some amazing photographs taken by a man named Kurt Gunther of life on the 1964 tour of the Americas. These are photos that have never before been on public display, so we're really fortunate to have those in the exhibit. You know, most photos and most experiences you'll see with the Beatles are looking toward the Beatles, looking at the Beatles, the view of from the seats, so to speak. And the wonderful thing about these photos and this experience is you get the Beatles' perspective. So you're getting photographs looking out the windows of the limo with, you know, crowded streets and fans pounding on the hood. And you see shots from behind the backs of the guys while they're on stage performing. So you really get a sense of what it was like to be a Beatle in this insane pandemonium that was Beatlemania. And in fact, it got so crazy that the Beatles had to stop touring, which is something I didn't know before working on this project. But the Beatles stopped touring, and that leads us to the third gallery, which we call In the Studio.
Yes, because so that really was a huge line where they realized between the screaming, nobody could hear what they were doing, but they were also getting so creative in the studio, they really wasn't something that could be recreated on that. When you think about the three guitars and the little drum kit that they were using in their touring days.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, they got to the point where they couldn't even hear themselves playing their songs because of the screaming fans. So at that point, I think they needed to make a switch. And we're happy they did. I mean, they ended up working in the studio with the legendary George Martin, who has sadly passed away just a couple months ago. But they were, as you say, incredibly innovative and imaginative and inventive. And they used stuff like, you know, rooster crows and crowd noise and different mixing and recording techniques to come up with, you know, what is easily some of the most innovative music that's ever been produced.
In a sense, they were using the recording studio as an instrument.
Yeah, they certainly were. And the exhibit has some of the original recording equipment, the original device that George R. Martin used to hear the Beatles for the very first time and basically discover them and help them produce this amazing music. It's a really wonderful, and it's also incredibly interactive part of the exhibition. You get to toy with some of the techniques and, you know, fast forward and play them in reverse and play random snippets of recorded tape, which are all techniques that the Beatles and George Martin used.
And then came 1970 and the breakup.
The final part of the gallery is all about that. For many teenage girls back then, life was over when the Beatles broke up. But as we know, life wasn't really over. And each of the four Beatles went on to have amazing careers and lives after the Beatles broke up. You know, they went on to star in films. And of course, they continued to create wonderful music. They wrote poetry. They created works of art. They started families. The last and final gallery really touches on the lives of the Beatles after the Beatles. It's a nice bit of closure to realize that though the band as an entity ended, the spirit and the life and certainly the influence of the Beatles did not come to an end.
Will, give us a couple of the artifacts that are really going to blow people away, things that really you were thrilled to be able to get to put into the exhibit and that really no one's seen. You mentioned those photographs, but you have artifacts as well.
Since we're speaking about the last gallery, one of the probably most emotional artifacts is the Double Fantasy album that John Lennon signed for Mark David Chapman just hours before Chapman eventually assassinated John Lennon. So it's got the police evidence log number written on it. It's got Chapman's fingerprints on it, Lennon's fingerprints. So it's significant in more ways than one. What it really did was signify the end of any possibility of the Beatles getting back together, when John Lennon was killed. It's a piece where everybody stops and looks at it. It's sort of set apart from the other artifacts. We've had real Beatlemaniacs in the exhibit who have become emotional when they see this piece. And you don't have to be a true Beatlemaniac to appreciate the significance, but it's definitely a moving bit of Beatles history.
Will, I get why those of us, and I'm one of them, who were screaming for the Beatles in 1964 want to see this, but why is it you think the Beatles matter so much to fans who weren't us, who were not baby boomers and who are kind of, you know, looking back, not having lived through Beatlemania, but drawn to their music and who they were?
That's a great question, and it's one that has sort of driven the production of this project and the creation of this exhibit. You know, we've seen everybody from octogenarians to eight-year-old kids coming through this exhibit, and they all have the same look on their face, which is just, you know, they're in awe of what the Beatles have done. I mean, the eight-year-olds maybe don't quite appreciate it, but they have fun. They're, you know, the Beatles' music was poppy, and it was catchy, and it was, you know, easy to listen to, easy to sing along with. Anybody who appreciates music is going to appreciate what the Beatles have done. Beyond that, you know, they've influenced countless artists and musicians and fashionistas and will continue to do so. I mean, I'm sure there are Beatles fans out there who haven't even been born yet.
The Magical History Tour, a Beatles memorabilia exhibition, is going to be at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn from now through September 18th. You can get details at thehenryford.org. Will Peterson of EDG put this together. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Will.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us, Cynthia.
Climate change is a true global challenge, but as much as it demands sweeping top-down global responses, climate change also demands bottom-up local action, and that's happening in Detroit. After 4 years, Detroit has produced a massive climate action plan. Kimberly Hillnott is leading development of this plan. She's with Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice and with the Detroit Climate Action Collaborative. Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Climate change is certainly an issue that mankind is facing, humankind is facing. It is global. Why does the city of Detroit need its own climate plan?
Well, I think that what you said is so important. It is a global issue. And so I had the opportunity to go to Paris last December, and also to Copenhagen, Denmark in 2009. And it was in Copenhagen, Denmark that I really recognized that because it is such a global issue, every single city has a responsibility to address climate change and to make sure that their residents are being protected from the dangers of this emerging issue.
So besides the Detroiters working for environmental justice, who else has been involved in putting the Detroit Climate Action Plan together?
Well, that's a great question, because it is probably one of the most collaborative efforts in the entire city. So we have the academic community, which is University of Michigan. We have Wayne State University. We have the U.S. Green Building Council, Detroit chapter. We have General Motors. We have Ford Motor Company. We have DTE Energy. We have the Michigan Environmental Council. And that's just to name a few.
That's a real big cross-section. So this is a plan that isn't put together by government and handed down, but it really is from a cross-section of the community.
That is correct. In addition to those key stakeholders, we've also had focus groups with members of the community. We've had a series of community-based meetings. And so there are many different voices that will be reflected in the Climate Action Plan, which will be released very soon.
Before we get into kind of what's in that plan, are there things that we could point to that numbers show us, yes, climate change has specifically affected Detroit?
Yes, we do. We have what is called the Detroit Climatology, and that was developed by GLESA, which is an initiative between or a program between the University of Michigan and Michigan State University, where scientists have come together to look at climate-related issues. And so our climatology shows us that if we do not do anything to address climate change by the year 2020, within a few years, we will see as many as 250 heat-related deaths per year. And so these are very startling numbers, because we know that by doing our job to address climate change, we can actually impact the most serious impacts of or effects of climate change. And so we also, our climatology also shows the increase in precipitation. And what we are seeing, the 2014 historical flood, that was an example of climate change. So these 1 in 100 year floods are happening much more frequently. And that's concerning for many reasons, not only for the infrastructure, but also for health reasons. When you have that much water that is coming down at such a rapid pace, well, it overwhelms the infrastructure system. So the city of Detroit has a combined sewer system. And so what that means is that when that water is mixed with, the stormwater is mixed with the sewage contents, then partially treated or untreated sewage actually seeps into the Detroit River. Well, that creates a problem, and also Lake Erie and other water basins. That creates a problem because there are many people in the city of Detroit who fish in the Detroit River. So it's a matter of food security, but it's also a matter of quality of life.
It's certainly a ripple effect that just keeps spreading and spreading. I'm talking with Kimberly Hill Nutt, who's been leading the development of Detroit's first climate action plan. So I know you're getting ready to release the plan, Kimberly, but give us a sense of the components, some of the main elements of the Detroit plan.
Well, some of the main components of the plan, because we are an urban city, we recognize that we could not do a plan that just focused on adaptation, which is really how cities prepare for the ultimate, the inevitable impact of climate change. But we also had to focus on mitigation. That was very important because the city of Detroit is home to two of the most polluted zip codes in the entire state. And so the mitigation part, as well as the adaptation part, are both very important. So our goals are actually reflective of both. And so we're not only looking at how do we reduce carbon pollution by investing in energy efficiency and encouraging businesses to start out by just doing an energy audit, but we're also looking at how do we increase investment in green infrastructure? How do we spread green infrastructure and particularly targeted green infrastructure? So we're not just looking at planting trees for aesthetic purposes, but really planting trees to improve the quality of life in the areas that are most susceptible and vulnerable to the impact of climate change.
What will individuals be asked to do under the Climate Action Plan? Because I think this, you touched on this a bit earlier, that individuals just feel this is just so big. What could little old me possibly do to really affect change?
Well, I mean, one of the things that people can do is reduce their energy usage. So our greenhouse gas inventory, which was actually conducted by the University of Michigan, the School of Natural Resources, and the Center for Sustainable Systems, showed that one of the biggest kind of contributors to greenhouse gas emissions were homes and buildings and facilities. And so those type of sectors, including transportation, of course, but these are things that people can do. They can reduce the energy usage within their homes by investing in energy efficiency products, lights, appliances, working with city government to make sure that residents are able to take advantage of renewable energy like solar power. People can actually also reduce their reliance on transportation. And so it would be great if we had a really strong public transportation system that could link to all of the major thoroughfares in our city.
This sounds, it sounds great, and it sounds at this point like a wish list.
Well, yes, it is a wish list, but I believe that in order to implement anything, you have to have a list. And so our job is to develop research and to have an implementation plan for the action plan. And so the action plan, of course, is our wish list. But one of the things, I look at it as a wish list that can actually be implemented because of the partners that we have at the table. And I did fail to mention that we also have been fortunate enough to have the city of Detroit as well as the state of Michigan helping us with this plan.
Kimberly, what do you think a climate-resilient Detroit will look like? What's your vision?
My vision of a climate-resilient Detroit is really more cooling centers that are available when we have extreme heat. So right now we have, obviously there are some that are available that I believe is through the Recreation Department or the Health Department, but it would be great to have those cooling centers actually correspond with our heat maps. So it would show the areas that are most susceptible to climate change. It would be great to have the city establish a sustainability office, and I believe that they are moving towards that. But the major one is just reducing the pollution in this city. So what are some creative things that can be done that business leaders can do to say, you know what, there is too much pollution in this city. How do we become good corporate neighbors and do our part to make sure that the city of Detroit is not only a prosperous, but it's also a livable city. It's a healthy city. It's a safe city. And so that's what a climate-resilient city looks like. It also includes, I forgot to mention, the economic factor, meaning that as these buildings are being retrofitted, that Detroiters are giving an opportunity to participate in this economic revival that will come through renewable energy and other clean sources of energy.
Kimberly Hillnott has been leading the development for the past 4 years of Detroit's first climate action plan. It was great to talk with you, Kimberly, and we'll be following through as you get this out and released and up and running. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
And it has been my pleasure. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's engineer was Peg Watson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.